DBHDD is urging people to ask a pharmacist about getting naloxone for their first aid kits at home or work. No prescription is needed. Naloxone can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose and restore breathing. Opioidresponse.info.
Coming up in this episode... But then things changed. You may recall the seminal moment of 1906.
Yeah, I did a story on that, the Atlanta Race Massacre.
Yeah, the Atlanta Race Massacre, where it's still not clear how many black people were killed.
Go away, get this jolly good education, and when you can come back, things will have changed and you could probably be quite helpful.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge.
Orlando, I hope you're in the mood for a bit of history today.
I hope it's not my own personal history. We're not going to...
Could we get into your personal history some other podcast, perhaps? Not here.
Not here.
No, we're going to talk about American history. And I think the way we're going to get into it today is really cool, because we're going to go into American history through the lens of one family's history, a black family's history in particular.
And so who is the family?
The family is that of David Levering Lewis. Now, this might be a familiar name to historians and lovers of history, because he's won the Pulitzer Prize twice for his biographies of W.E.B. Du Bois. He's also written about Martin Luther King Jr. And he's got some Atlanta roots. So that's the qualification for this podcast, right? Some connection to Georgia. And the book is called The Stained Glass Window, A Family History as the American Story, 1790 to 1958.
That's a lot of American history.
That is a lot of American history. And it's worth following in this particular way, right? Because it's not necessarily about what the government is doing and what laws were passed. That's part of it. But it's really tracing the movements of ordinary people. Right, ordinary people, when they first appear in the census in some cases, and when they first appear in other records, and why they're there and what they're doing. It's a fascinating take, and I think David Levering Lewis does a really good job, so I'm excited to tell you about it.
So The Stained Glass Window, A Family History. What is The Stained Glass Window?
So The Stained Glass Window is the inspiration for this book. It's found in the First Congregational Church in Atlanta, and the window is a tribute to his maternal grandmother, Alice King Bell, who died in childbirth at age 29 in 1901.
So how old is the author then?
Okay, so David Levering Lewis is 88 years old, and he no longer lives in Atlanta, but has deep family roots here, and the book is essentially a capstone to his long and successful career. We spoke recently in front of a live audience at the Atlanta History Center, and he said that The Stained Glass Window was an inspiration for him to get personal.
I had reached a point in my life when I wanted to write personal history. I had been writing history about global stuff and that sort of thing. And I had had a conversation with the archivist at the Roswell Historical Society, when I noted that the Roswell Historical Society was observing Black History Month. And I thought, well, that's progress, isn't it? And I telephoned and I spoke to the archivist, who said, well, you'll be most welcome. Come and we'll talk. And you think that you have family connections here.
And so family connections, he has family connections in Roswell?
That's kind of an interesting story. Clarissa King, his great-grandmother, was born in 1835, and he had suspected that she and Roswell King, the namesake of the city, had had children. And Clarissa, of course, was enslaved, and Roswell King was the slave owner. So he traces official records to figure out where Clarissa King ended up, and they also got DNA tests. And it turns out that through records, he found that Clarissa had been moved, sold to someone in Houston County, Georgia, James Wiley Belvin, and later DNA revealed that he was not, in fact, the descendant of Roswell King, but in fact, the descendant of James Wiley Belvin, the man who bought Clarissa King.
Did that surprise him?
It was a surprise that it wasn't one of James Wiley Belvin's younger sons, but it wasn't a surprise that a white man had taken advantage of an enslaved black woman. And that's something that the author does throughout the book. He shows how members of his family are caught up in the American story at any given moment. And at that time, the exploitation of black people in all manner of ways was pretty common.
So you said that Lewis had Atlanta roots. How far back are we talking about?
Well, it goes back to the 1800s. Clarissa, his great-grandmother, who we were just talking about, she was essentially gifted by James Wiley Belvin a beautiful Victorian house on what is now Auburn Avenue in Atlanta, which if you're in Atlanta, you know that's the center of black commerce. And here's how he explains what happened there with respect to that house being gifted to Clarissa.
There was an indenture that he created to give to Clarissa. In it, he attached a reversionary clause that if Clarissa did not produce or if her line expired, the property would revert to him, Major James Wiley Belvin. But then there was a second indenture, the first in 1879, significant. The second indenture in 1881. And in that indenture, he relinquished all property rights to the Victorian house and gave in permanence the indenture to Clarissa and her issue, provided there was never a commingling of marital rights with the rights of the descendants of Clarissa.
So it's an unusual move for the time for a man who has enslaved a woman to also bestow upon her a valuable piece of property, because that property essentially sets up her lineage, gives some measure of security to the family, including his grandmother, Alice King Bell, Clarissa's daughter, the woman on the stained glass window.
So family histories can get very confusing very quickly. We've got Kings, we've got Lewis's, we've got Bells.
Yeah.
What about all the other branches of the family? Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, I could talk briefly and just say that the family tree does get confusing even when you read the book, but I'll try to keep names to a minimum here. If you have the book in hand, you'll have the benefit of the actual illustrated family tree so you can follow along and kind of remind yourself of who is who. But you asked about the Bells. The Bells are interesting. They hail from South Carolina. John Henry Bell is the man who ultimately marries Alice King, so he's the maternal grandfather. The Bells go back to 1790. They appear in the first census. Essentially, there's a black woman.
The first census of, like, the U.S.?
The first census of the U.S., 1790. A black woman on the census grows up to oversee a plantation worked on by other black people who are eventually freed, but they keep working.
Because they were really productive, but they craved anonymity in a society in which really there was slavery and there was enslavement. They, however, were sort of straddling the history of this experience.
And here's where Lewis really describes the shifting understanding of race in America. That's, you know, mid-1800s, and we're familiar now with the one-drop rule, right? We've talked about that.
We've talked about it on the previous podcast.
Yeah, essentially meaning one black person in one's lineage meant you are black in the society. Well, that's not how it necessarily was back in the mid-1800s during the days of slavery. David Levering Lewis quotes in this book Judge William Harper of South Carolina in 1835, in a case in which a man who appeared white had a black ancestor and was accused of passing for white. And here's what that judge said. I found it really interesting. "We cannot say what admixture of Negro blood will make a colored person. The condition of the individual is not to be determined solely by distinct and visible mixture of Negro blood, but by reputation, by his reception into society and his having commonly exercised the privileges of a white man." So that's a quote from a judge back in 1835, and that's the kind of environment that the Bells were living in when they were working a plantation that was also overseen by a black woman but owned by a white man. So it was an interesting scenario.
So they get to Atlanta somehow.
Yeah, David Levering Lewis explains how they made it from South Carolina to Atlanta.
As the Civil War were going in the wrong direction for the Stars and Bars, the American Missionary Association had begun to patrol the plantations to say, you know, it looks like you're not going to win, and you have obligations to lots of people, and we, the American Missionary Association, are going to create educational institutions in the prostrate South, especially Atlanta. And you might think that this is a place to send many people when Sherman passes through, which is exactly what happens.
So they come here basically for education.
Right. And the author's father, John Henry Lewis, sorry, another name, he was a principal and a teacher. His mother was a teacher as well. Very accomplished, well-educated family. They did well in Atlanta for a lot of years. Business along Wheat Street and then Auburn Avenue. Businesses were doing well there. The black churches were funding the black schools. There was a large congregation, so there was a lot of support for those schools. But then things changed. You may recall the seminal moment of 1906.
Yeah, I did a story on that, the Atlanta Race Massacre.
Yeah, the Atlanta Race Massacre, where it's still not clear how many black people were killed. This was a decade after Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court case, which had by then made separate but equal the law of the land, and that pushed the one-drop rule. Racial tensions were pretty high, and lots of black people in Atlanta decided to leave Atlanta after the 1906 race massacre, part of the Great Migration. In 1906, there were 68,000 registered black voters in Atlanta, but that was down to just over 11,000 by 1918. So over that time, businesses did worse and worse. Auburn Avenue, where the King Bells lived, it wasn't doing so well. Schools were starting to struggle because parishioners fled, and the big company at the time, Standard Life Insurance, that was really falling apart.
So how was his family impacted by all of this economic downturn?
Well, there's a lot to be said about that, but to summarize, John Henry Bell, his grandfather, died by suicide at the Auburn Avenue home after Standard Life collapsed and his policies lost value. And David Levering Lewis was raised elsewhere because his parents left town and saw education jobs outside of Georgia.
So you said that David Levering Lewis, the author, was a Pulitzer Prize winner and noted historian. Does he say anything about himself?
Not much, no. He doesn't really trade in his historian's hat for that of a memoirist, which to me seems fine. I mean, he does end the book with his father's last message to him. Lewis was heading off to study in England and was not present for his father's death. But before his death, he sent this note. And this was in 1958, after Brown versus Board of Education ruled that separate but equal was unconstitutional. And Lewis's father wrote to him, "Wait until you can be useful." And that's how he ends the book. And I asked David Levering Lewis what he thought his father meant by that.
I think he wrote at that time, Brown had really not worked. The Eisenhower presence was a disaster for the implementation of Warren's ideas. And I think he thought that, you know, go away, get this jolly good education, and when you can come back, things will have changed and you can probably be quite helpful. I think that was it.
From a reading perspective, what gives this book the narrative edge?
Well, there are a few things. The first thing that stands out to me is the book really mines the historical record hard. I mean, you don't have written diaries for enslaved people. Many of them, if they could read or write, they were compelled to hide that fact. So we don't have journals of what they experienced. We don't have Clarissa King's journal, for example, if there ever was one. We have tax records, we have bills of sale to kind of figure out where they were, how old they were, when they were there. And then we have kind of circumstantial evidence to figure out what ideas those people may have encountered at the time. Like we know, for example, the ideas of Booker T. Washington may have been influential in Atlanta in the mid-1890s because of speeches he made there. And we know that the Bells living in Atlanta likely lived in a culture of fear after the Atlanta Race Massacre. So David Levering Lewis does, I think, a really good job of filling in the blanks for us by capturing the social and historical context.
But what about the writing? I mean, is it a pleasure to read?
I would say it is a pleasure to read once you get the hang of the way David Levering Lewis writes and speaks. I mean, we've heard in one of the clips in this podcast that, you know, he talks about children as quote unquote issue, which to me sounds like an old fashioned word. So when you get used to the kind of verbiage that he's used to using, you kind of see the poetry in it. And there are no wasted words. I think that's lovely. I think his sentences challenge you to follow a complicated but ultimately beautiful, insightful sentence. And I actually appreciated that he resisted whatever temptation he may have had to talk about himself explicitly. Like, we see a little bit of him in his interactions with his father, but we get enough of him by viewing his own family's history through his eyes, and it's, I think, certainly worth the look.
Did you keep track of, like, the longest sentence?
No, but because I got an advanced reader's copy, it didn't have the actual family tree in it, so I had to sort of make my own family tree in the margins as I was reading to keep track.
But the real book that our listeners will get, that does have the family tree.
Yes. If you go in the bookstore and you pick up one of these, it's going to have the family tree inside the first few pages. So no worries there. You're going to keep track of people just fine. And it's worth it. It's really worth it because you just kind of get a personal sense of what the average person was living through at that time.
So the book is called The Stained Glass Window by David Levering Lewis. Peter, thanks for telling me about it.
Happy to.
Thanks for listening to Narrative Edge. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. This podcast is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Find us online at gpb.org/narrativeedge.
You can also catch us on the daily GPB News podcast, Georgia Today, for a concise update on the latest news in Georgia. For more on that and all of our podcasts, go to gpb.org/podcasts.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
Kickoff for Super Bowl 34.
The Titans-Rams 2000 Super Bowl, an instant classic. Hours after the game, two men were stabbed in the street, accused of being in the middle, the greatest linebacker in NFL history.
Ray Lewis and two friends are charged with murder.
The nation's eyes were glued to their televisions. The trial concluded, and the verdicts came back. Not guilty.
What you can learn from all this is that big cases make for big mistakes. Look what happened to O.J. Simpson, and look what happened to Ray Lewis.
Lewis went on to have a Hall of Fame career, but questions around that night in Atlanta still remain.
So where do you think they're hiding?
They know what happened. They know exactly what happened.
After 20 years, it's time to get to the bottom line truth. From Tenderfoot TV, I'm Tim Livingston, and this is The Raven. Listen for free on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.